Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Save the Trees edition. Today our featured guest is Kirkland & Ellis partner Jeffrey Clark, discussing Summers v. Earth Island Institute, heard an oral argument on Wednesday, October 8th. Thanks for tuning in. In this case, the Supreme Court considers the justiciability of challenges to certain Forest Service regulations authorizing logging in areas damaged by fire without various procedures Congress had generally specified for forest management. The Earth Island Institute and other environmental groups brought a facial and as-applied challenge to these regulations. The as-applied challenge was settled, but the environmental plaintiffs maintained their facial challenge and obtained a nationwide injunction against application of the rules. The Ninth Circuit upheld the injunction, and the Supreme Court now considers whether the facial challenge presents a proper subject for judicial review, whether the respondents have established standing, whether the subject remains ripe, and whether the nationwide injunction was proper. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Clark.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's podcast on Summers v. Earth Island Institute. The Federalist Society probably has a greater proportion of members with a high tolerance for the exploration of doctrines only a lawyer could love than perhaps a random sample of bar members. But the case I'm about to discuss, Summers, is rife with justiciability doctrines, standing, ripeness, mootness, and the proper boundaries of the Administrative Procedure Act's causes of action and available relief. Though such doctrine floats my boat as a devotee of administrative law in Article 3, the abstract nature of the discussion may bore many listeners. So, you have been warned, and on to the discussion. First, let's talk about some of the necessary background for this case, and let me divide that into two parts, a legal background and a factual background. The legal background of this case shows a largely unified executive branch across time, going back to Bush 41, running up through the Clinton administration and stretching up to Bush 43, the current administration, all being opposed by Congress, on the other hand. Before 1992, decisions of the Forest Service that weren't documented were generally not subject to internal appeal within the agency. The favorite example of this for the environmental respondents in this case are activities like cutting Christmas trees in national forests, which the court had a laugh about at oral argument, as I will describe later. Documented decisions, however, were appealable within the agency, even if they were environmentally insignificant. In 1992, the Bush 41 administration proposed eliminating administrative appeals for project-level decisions. Congress strongly opposed doing that, however, and reacted by adopting the so-called Forest Service Decision-Making and Appeals Reform Act, or ARA. The ARA states that the Secretary of Agriculture, acting through the Chief of the Forest Service, shall establish a notice and comment process for proposed actions of the Forest Service concerning projects and activities implementing land and resource management plans. The ARA also notes that anyone who filed oral or written comments on such projects has a right to file an appeal of any such project determination. The Clinton administration filed regulations implementing the ARA in 1993. Those regulations provided that all decisions that were categorically excluded from review under the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, because such actions had no environmental effect, were exempt from notice and comment under the ARA, except for timber sales. Respondent environmental group Heartwood challenged the 1993 regulations in 1999. In September 2000, a consent decree was entered effectuating the settlement in the Southern District of Illinois. The consent decree added 10 formally categorically exempt activities to the timber sale exceptions, the new exceptions including things like mineral exploration and controlled burns. The effect of the exceptions was to preserve ARA notice and comment procedures and internal agency appeals for those types of actions. Enter the Bush 43 current administration. In 2003, it finalized the new ARA regulations in response to and following on the consent decree. The new ARA regulations expanded the categories of ARA-exempt activities to include all categorical exclusions for NEPA purposes, including even timber sales. Since their adoption, those regulations have been applied to thousands of decisions nationwide. So that was the legal background. Now on to the precise factual and procedural background. In September 2003, the Forest Service approved the Burnt Ridge timber salvage sale in the Sequoia National Forest, which is in central California, several hundred miles north of Los Angeles. About 1.6 million board feet of timber was to be logged in that project. In the view of the Forest Service, the salvage sale had no real adverse environmental effects and thus was categorically excluded under NEPA. Hence, by virtue of the 2003 ARA regulations, it was exempt from notice, comment, and the Forest Service's appeal process. In December 2003, Earth Island and several other environmental groups filed the underlying lawsuit in the Eastern District of California. The first six claims in that complaint asserted various challenges to the legality of the Burnt Ridge sale. The seventh claim is the most salient to the issues before the Supreme Court, however. That seventh claim was a facial challenge, arguing that the 2003 regulations were contrary to the ARA because there was no basis for exempting from the ARA's required procedures types of actions that were categorically excluded under NEPA. There were eight other claims, but they are irrelevant to our discussion. Based on a declaration by one Aram Margarosian, the district court granted a preliminary injunction against the Burnt Ridge sale on December 10, 2003. In March 2004, the Forest Service withdrew the Burnt Ridge project in a partial settlement of a lawsuit. The settlement barred the Burnt Ridge project from being reinitiated before the Forest Service did an environmental impact statement, EIS, under NEPA for the sale. Based on the settlement, the specific Burnt Ridge project counts of the complaint were dismissed. What remained of the lawsuit then was a direct facial challenge to the 2003 regulations as contrary to the ARA. The district court held that at least one of the respondents had constitutional standing to challenge the regulations facially. That respondent was environmental group Heartwood, whose employee and member Jim Bensman, an Illinois resident who had submitted a declaration in support of standing, was the one who here supported the standing allegations the district court accepted. Bensman averred that he visited a number of national forests and had expressed a view he would visit unidentified national forests in Colorado, California, Indiana, and Oregon later that year. He also stated he had commented on 1,000 Forest Service projects in the past and had often administratively appealed, sometimes with success, various Forest Service decisions. Bensman's only tie-in to the 2003 regulations, however, was that those regulations were applied to 20 unidentified timber sales in the Allegheny National Forest, according to his averments. That forest is located in Pennsylvania, and it included places that Bensman had visited and stated he wanted to go back to again. He did not state that he had concrete plans to visit those Allegheny sites in the near future, however. Nevertheless, the district court found constitutional standing. The district court also found that the facial challenge was ripe because the 2003 regulations were the Forest Service's definitive position and they had been enforced on numerous occasions. On the merits, the district court found that the Forest Service could exclude environmentally insignificant projects from the procedural protections of the ARA, but the district court found that major and minor projects had not been properly distinguished in the regulations and in the project. In September 2005, the district court issued a further clarifying order stating that its injunction against the 2003 regulations applied nationwide. In October 2005, the district court again clarified its injunction and held that the 2003 regulations validly exempted those activities categorically excluded under NEPA, with the exception of timber sales and the 10 categories of action from the Heartland suit back in the year 2000. The Ninth Circuit affirmed in part and reversed in part. The panel was led by authoring Chief Judge Mary Schroeder, joined by Judge Graber and a senior Southern District of New York judge, Judge Duffy. The Ninth Circuit found that the respondents had standing to sue based on the Bensman Declaration. The Ninth Circuit's theory of standing was that Bensman's exclusion from participation in the administrative appeals process at the Forest Service may yield diminished recreational enjoyment of the national forests. The Ninth Circuit also upheld standing based on a procedural standing theory. Specifically, loss of the right to an administrative appeal was found to confer sufficient injury in fact. The Ninth Circuit found most of the challenges to the 2003 regulations were unripe, however, because ripeness ordinarily requires regulations to be applied in a concrete factual setting. The Ninth Circuit held in favor of the respondent's challenge that projects qualifying for NEPA categorical exclusions could not be stripped out of ARA procedural protections. The Ninth Circuit found this challenge was tied to the Burnt Ridge sale and that it was immaterial that the aspects of the suit challenging the sale had already been settled. The Ninth Circuit justified its ruling that exempting environmentally significant projects from ARA protections by arguing that the statute was plain and did not mention NEPA, let alone create exemptions for projects that were treated as categorically exempt from NEPA review. Hence, according to the Ninth Circuit, every Forest Service decision implicating a Forest Service plan or project had to go through notice and comment and be subject to an administrative appeal process within the agency. The Ninth Circuit upheld the district court's issuance of a nationwide injunction, however. The Ninth Circuit found that the issuance of a nationwide injunction was not only permissible, but mandatory. because the text of APA Section 706-2A provided that agency action found unlawful must be held unlawful and set aside. So that was the Ninth Circuit's rationale. The respondents are not defending the Ninth Circuit's ruling on the merits. They conceded that the ARA permits the Forest Service to exclude environmentally insignificant projects from the agency appeals process. Thus, the only questions presented to the Supreme Court in this case are the following four. Number one, do the plaintiffs have standing? Two, is their facial challenge to the 2003 regulations ripe? Three, did the Burnt Ridge settlement moot their facial challenge? And four, did the district court properly order nationwide injunctive relief, assuming that the case is justiciable? Let me briefly describe the basic dispute on each of these four issues and then go on to a description of what happened in oral argument. On standing, every Federalist Society member should know that there are three elements of constitutional standing. One, injury in fact girded by a protectable right. Two, causation making the challenged conduct, or here agency action, the fairly traceable source of the claimed injury in fact. And three, redressability, the ability of the court to order relief that will help to alleviate or compensate for the claimed injury in fact. Each element must be satisfied. The position of the government is that there is no injury in fact from the 2003 regulations and their overarching facial abstractness unless tied to some site-specific injury to the interests in or use of the national forests for a particular individual who is a member of one of the plaintiff respondent groups. Hence, once the Burnt Ridge project dispute was settled out of the case, there was no remaining injury in fact. The plaintiff's position is that they are recurring litigants. Stripping them of procedural rights at least increases the likelihood that they will not be able to vindicate their substantive rights in enjoying the national forests without unlawful intrusion or reduction of those rights by the Forest Service. They also argue that since the procedural rights which they're losing involve a loss of formal notice, if they don't find out about projects, they can't know if they might disagree with the Forest Service about the environmental effects of such projects on the substantive rights of the members of their organizations. On ripeness, every Federal Society member should also have internalized the two-part test of Abbott Labs on ripeness. The first part is fitness for review, which means typically that you're dealing with purely legal questions or predominantly legal questions. They're the ones most likely to satisfy the fitness test. And the second part is hardship. What's the damage done to the plaintiff if review is postponed until later, with ripeness being found more readily if there's immediate hardship and less readily if hardship will be delayed? The government's position is that challenges to the 2003 regulations can await the time when such questions arise in connection with particular Forest Service activities in the national forests. The government argues that there are only two situations in which pre-enforcement review of a set of regulations can occur. Number one, if Congress creates a special statute to authorize or require such pre-enforcement review, or two, if the regulated parties must immediately adjust their conduct in response to the agency action in question, even before it is enforced. The government argues that the 2003 ARA regulations fall into neither of those categories. The environmental plaintiffs, by contrast, argue that the discussion in Lujan of the two special review statute and immediate effect on conduct situations are not intended to be the only situations in which ripeness can be shown. Instead, according to them, as long as they can beat the balancing test, the two-part balancing test of Abbott Labs, then they have brought a ripe case. Turning to mootness. In the Supreme Court's case, Laidlaw v. Friends of the Earth, the court held that standing and mootness are not entirely symmetrical. Once standing attaches, even if things change on the ground, it is quite hard to secure dismissal of a case as moot, even if under the current state of affairs, standing to bring such a suit might no longer exist. In Laidlaw, the environmental plaintiffs brought suit against a company that was engaged in water pollution. The company settled with state authorities claims under the Federal Clean Water Act against it, putting it in compliance with federal permit limits. Also, the relevant facility was shut down. Despite these facts, the Laidlaw majority refused to find mootness for the disputes at issue in that case because there was no showing that the violations of the Clean Water Act at the site could not reasonably be expected to recur. The government distinguishes Laidlaw, arguing that unilateral voluntary cessation was involved there, whereas here, the Burnt Ridge multilateral settlement committed the Forest Service to be bound to perform an environmental impact statement, known as an EIS, under NEPA. That means that notice, comment, and administrative appeal procedures will attach in favor of the environmental groups on the Burnt Ridge EIS. The main defense of the environmental groups on mootness is that if they are right, that their facial challenge is ripe, then it cannot be moot. That's because mootness of an as-applied challenge, i.e. the subject of what was settled in terms of the Burnt Ridge Project, does not mean that a facial challenge is mooted. Facial challenges and as-applied challenges are different things. For that proposition, they rely on an important decision from Judge Ginsburg on the D.C. Circuit. Turning to the nationwide injunction issue, on the question of whether that was improper, the government's position is that injunctions or the set-aside remedy of the APA are equitable remedies. Hence, under cases like Weinberger v. Romero-Barcello and its predecessors and successors, the court must be free to decide the scope of relief as a discretionary matter. In some instances, nationwide relief may be proper, but ordinarily, against the government, a nationwide injunction would be unlawful or inappropriate because it runs against the principle of allowing the government to develop circuit splits that will let it take cases to the Supreme Court, because it locks the government essentially into the first loss it experiences in any circuit. Accordingly, the Ninth Circuit was clearly wrong in finding the APA mandated nationwide relief here just because the 2003 regulations being challenged facially were nationwide in scope. The environmental plaintiffs agree that the matter is one for discretion, hence disagreeing again with the Ninth Circuit, but nevertheless argue that the district court properly exercised its discretion to issue a nationwide injunction. The plaintiffs argue that the government's argument is based on Mendoza, and the collateral estoppel ruling in that case says nothing about whether the APA permits agency regulations of nationwide scope to be enjoined or set aside on a nationwide basis. This case involves numerous important subsidiary questions about the proper construction of certain key provisions of the APA. The most important question in that regard is whether the 2003 regulations constitute reviewable final agency action. In the case of Norton v. Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, or SUWA, the Supreme Court held that some forms of agency action, while nonetheless final, might not be discrete enough to be reviewable final agency action. The plaintiffs concede such a category exists, but argue that it exists only where environmental plaintiffs try to cobble together a collection of agency activities they wished formed a unified whole, but in reality do not. Hence, they argue the 2003 regulations under the ARA were designated by the Forest Service as a unified whole, and hence they shouldn't be subject to this notion of being unreviewable final agency action. Okay, with those points under the bridge, let me turn to discussing what occurred at oral argument. This case was argued for the government petitioners by Deputy Solicitor General Edwin Needler and for the environmental respondents by Matt Kenna from the Western Environmental Law Center. The first line of argument the liberal justices saw as promising to find standing for the environmental plaintiffs was the notion that the procedural boons of notice, comment, and agency appeal rights were intended by Congress under the ARA to be conferred at a particular class of individuals, those who frequently commented on and litigated against the Forest Service. That line of argument was advanced by Justice Breyer. Needler responded that he did not think that that was sufficient for Article III purposes because procedural injury alone is insufficient to confer standing. It has to be coupled with some site-specific injury. The classic example of this is Justice Scalia's famous dam hypothetical from Lujan. Someone who lived next to a dam where NEPA analysis was not performed or not enough of it was performed would have standing to bring a NEPA cause of action against the builders or authorizers of the dam. But someone who had no nexus with the dam would lack standing to claim that simply because Congress had given them a procedural right to bring a NEPA cause of action, that would satisfy Article III. Justice Souter launched the next pro-plaintiff line of standing questions. He was concerned that if the rulings below were reversed on standing grounds, there might be some forms of unlawful Forest Service conduct violating the ARA that might never get judicially reviewed. Needler's response here was basically that such a hypothetical is not this case. When really pressed, he appeared to concede that maybe in such a situation where judicial review would not occur, standing would exist, but that territory was probably reclaimed after Justice Scalia did some repair questioning. It is interesting that Needler did not advance the purist position that if application of standing meant that some violations of the ARA statute would go unreviewed by the courts, so be it. That does not mean that Article III must be watered down. Surely, Congress is prohibited from creating numerous causes of action by other constitutional provisions like equal protection or the First Amendment. No one regards this as remarkable. Why should Article III making some agency action unreviewable be treated as remarkable? Indeed, if it speaks clearly, Congress can make agency action unreviewable at its own option. In his questions, Justice Stevens tried to broaden the Justice Souter point out to an exception to Article 3, finding standing if a plaintiff could merely show that on 3 or 4 occasions they didn't get notice by some means of Forest Service action exempted under the 2003 regulations from formal notice comment in administrative appeal rights. Ed Miebler's response to that was to say, no such situations tied to areas of the national forest used by the plaintiffs here had really been identified. He also noted that the nature of these plaintiff groups is that they are well known to the Forest Service, and they are given informal notice of actions that might prejudice their claimed interest, often by letter. Here it is interesting that the government's response was not to call this kind of thinking a policy-based exception to constitutional standing, i.e. standing must exist wherever a lack of government notice deprives potentially injured individuals of the information to let them know they've been injured. To state such a category is to imagine how odd it is. Perhaps this is a policy that many individuals would vote for. If the government is going to take some hidden action that might hurt me, I have to be informed of it. But since standing is a constitutional matter, it's not clear why that kind of concern counts as constitutional reasoning. As a constitutional matter, why couldn't the courts decide that a hidden injury isn't actionable until it is discovered? Remember, that's all that's at stake. No one disputes that a hidden injury is always justiciable once discovered. The question is whether standing exists to litigate over whether there may be procedural rights that preclude the possibility of any hidden injuries. It's like a protective kind of statute that precludes hidden injuries from ever occurring in the first place. Justice Kennedy asked only 2 questions, and they both branched out of Justice Stevens' worry about individuals not receiving notice of actions within the national forests. Unfortunately, since it's likely he's the swing voter here, Justice Kennedy asked the question in one formulation suggesting he thinks standing didn't exist, and in another formulation that suggests he did think it exists. Here's the first formulation. After being informed of 1,300 individuals who in the past had expressed an interest in Burnt Ridge being sent informal notice letters by the Forest Service, Justice Kennedy asked whether any one of those could have brought suit. But he also asked, in a different formulation, whether the criteria for sending the letters had been framed broadly enough. When Ed Miebler told him the criteria for sending out informal notices included everyone who had ever expressed an interest in the project, Justice Kennedy replied, oh, okay. Perhaps this means his concern about the practical point of whether concerned parties got noticed by one means or another was satisfied, but it's really hard to say. Justice Ginsburg then jumped in with a line of questions conceptualizing the ARA procedural rights as similar to rights in the public to get government documents under the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA. Justice Scalia later responded for Kneedler on FOIA, arguing that FOIA grants rights to obtain access to particular documents the requester asks for, and thus it does not involve a concrete dispute, whereas this case, in his view, seemed to involve an amorphous facial challenge to a set of regulations that were no longer tied to site-specific action. Perhaps coming to see it as the best shot for establishing standing, Justice Breyer then himself came to adopt the FOIA analogy. Indeed, in response to some statements by Deputy SG Kneedler, Justice Breyer explicitly said, I'm trying to make it look like FOIA. When Ed Miebler sat down with 3 minutes remaining for rebuttal, questioning turned to focus on the environmental respondents represented by Matt Canna. The Chief Justice was particularly forceful in his questioning of Mr. Canna, telling him he thought it seemed clear that his position could not be squared with Lujan. Mr. Canna tried to respond by fuzzing up the passage from Lujan on which the Chief was relying, emphasizing footnote 2 of the opinion containing some caveats. The Chief returned to his line of questioning later. He told Mr. Canna that he'd read that footnote, and he read it merely to restate what the Court was saying in the passage from Lujan that the Chief had quoted from earlier. The Chief also engaged in a line of questioning that suggested he had been unpersuaded by the environmental respondent's argument that because a final rule was involved in this case, Ohio forestry was irrelevant. In trying to resurrect the plaintiff's respondent's view that ARA rights should attach to any documented decision, but should not attach to decisions that were undocumented, Mr. Kennedy trotted out his Christmas tree hypothetical. Kennedy said, see, there is no decision approving the Christmas tree cutting. Chief Justice Roberts then asked in a mock tone of horror, you can cut down a tree in a national forest without approval? Laughter erupted in the courtroom. Justice Ginsburg used some questions to spin the settlement on the Burnt Ridge Project as depriving the plaintiffs of their right to seek facial review of the validity of the 2003 regulations. But though no justice on the conservative side pointed this out, that kind of argument seems weak because there was no indication in the record to state that the government had strategically settled the concrete part of the case out from under the plaintiffs. Instead, the settlement essentially led to full procedural rights to challenge one particular timber sale, which was akin to the result under the Clinton-era ARA rules where there was a timber sale exception. Moreover, if the plaintiffs didn't want the concrete tie-in to a specific timber project to be severed out of the case, they were free not to accept the settlement. It takes two to tango. There is no unilateral power that the executive branch can use to avoid judicial review that's in play in this case. The chief and Mr. Canna also had an exchange about whether some post-judgment declarations designed to fix up some of the holes in the vague Benson declaration were properly in the case. Mr. Canna argued they were accepted by the district court, and thus were part of the record. But the chief asserted that there has to be an end to litigation, and that litigation would never end if a court found standing declarations wanting, and then the plaintiffs could come back with an endless cycle of new declarations designed to do a fix-up job. Finally, Justice Ginsburg asked Mr. Canna to say a word on the nationwide injunction issue. As you'll hear at the end, I think that issue is not going to divide the justices much or be very troubling to the court. Ed Kneedler then began his rebuttal. That caused Justice Stevens to set out his response to the passage from Lujan emphasized so heavily in the government's brief and in the remarks during argument by Chief Justice Roberts. Remember, this is the passage that says there are two categories where agency action can be right, where Congress creates a special review statute and where regulated parties must immediately adjust their conduct. But Justice Stevens' point was that no case says that those are the only two situations in which rightness can be found. Kneedler did not have a strong response to that or lack the time to deliver it. The one point Mr. Kneedler did make in rebuttal that was very effective was that the ARA was not written in terms of conferring rights on individuals, but merely to regulate government action. That was his response to Justice Breyer's questions about the plaintiffs here being exactly among the intended class of beneficiaries Congress had in mind when it designed the ARA procedural protections. Turning to predictions. On the standing and rightness issues, it looks like the conservative bloc of Chief Justice Roberts and Associate Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito will be facing off against the liberal bloc of Justices Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer. Which side wins is what's in the balance. Any predictions about how standing issues or rightness issues will come out here are hazardous, however, because Justice Kennedy is likely to be the swing vote, and he was quite inactive at oral argument. On the mootness and nationwide injunction issues, I think that the justices will find common ground relatively quickly. I think mootness is unlikely to be resolved as its own heading in this case. More likely, mootness will be an ingredient in the standing or rightness debates between the two sides. On the nationwide injunction issue, I think the parties' agreement about nationwide injunctions being a matter for the exercise of proper district court discretion will lead to the whole court reversing the Ninth Circuit's view that the issuance of a nationwide injunction here was mandatory under the APA. Weinberger v. Romero-Barcello and the Amico v. Gamble case, which invalidated an attempt in the past by the Ninth Circuit to presume that environmental cases are different and so injunctions must be granted to remedy such violations, both cases are quite clear. Equitable relief is inherently discretionary, never mandatory unless Congress clearly states as much, which it did not do either in the APA or in the ARA. I think a clear majority of the court will agree that one factor in this issuing nationwide injunctions that district courts will have to consider is that such an injunction should be presumptively unavailable against the government because, on the analogy to the Mendoza case, ordering nationwide injunctions eliminates the government's ability to develop a circuit split in such cases. One thing I will say about the nationwide injunction issue is that the government advanced what I think was a particularly ill-advised argument construing the text of the APA. The main remedy for violations of law, which is conferred by the APA cause of action, is an order from a court setting aside unlawful agency action. Here, the government argued that setting aside means merely ignoring the effect of some agency action for purposes of a particular case. They cited dictionary definitions for their point. The fatal problem with that argument, in my view, though, is that it has been well understood since the APA's inception that the set-aside remedy means vacature, i.e. holding the agency action to be void and emptying it of force entirely, vacating it. The plaintiffs were able to easily cite Black's Law Dictionary for that point, along with numerous other lay dictionaries. They really effectively demolished the government's argument here, and that's why that argument was notably absent from the government's reply brief. Well, thanks for listening to this Federalist Society podcast. Hope everyone will stay tuned for the outcome of this case. It could be a blockbuster in the realm of Article III jurisprudence and administrative law, with new standing, ripeness, and APA law being made. This has been Jeff Clark for the Federalist Society. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.